You're tuned in to This Week in Palestine, a space where truth is not tempered. Resistance is revered, and solidarity is the heartbeat of every story we tell. Here, voices from the epicenter of occupation rise to meet global movements for justice, dignity, and liberation. This is not just a broadcast, it's a lifeline, a thread between Gaza and the world. Between shattered homes and unshaken hope, between the rubble and the resolve. Each week, we bring you fearless reporting, sharp analysis, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, defiance, and humanity. We examine the machinery of empire, from the policies that suffocate to the propaganda that distorts and trace its reverberations across borders. From Ferguson to Jenin, refugee camps to classrooms, and Gaza to the global conscience. Before we begin, a brief but vital note. The views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite avoidance or sanitized soundbites. It is a space for truth, bold, urgent, and unapologetic. Good morning. Good evening, wherever you're tuning in from. Thank you for being here. I'm your host, Bethany Marks, and it is a deep and humbling honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, October 12, 2025. Once again, our gaze turns to Gaza, and the West Bank lands under siege. Where homes are reduced to dust, lives are uprooted, and voices struggle to rise above the din of global indifference. As headlines fade and attention shifts, the truth remains. Families endure relentless displacement. Communities resist with unshakable resolve, and the pursuit of dignity continues against staggering odds. And still, one question refuses to fade. How long must a people suffer before the world chooses conscience over convenience, action over apathy? Stay with us as we strip away the silence, uplift resilience, and carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is not mine alone. It's ours. It's shared. It's urgent. And it's sacred.
We will return to our home again. Look, son, I'm still holding the key.
What exactly is this so-called ceasefire deal with Israel? Is it truly a step toward peace or just another calculated maneuver? We have to ask, is this a genuine agreement or another cunning trick? Who are we really dealing with? How many times has Israel broken ceasefire agreements in the past? Has Netanyahu ever honored his word? Or does his record suggest otherwise? Can the current Israeli government be trusted, or is it operating with malicious intent? These are not rhetorical questions. They're rooted in history, in repeated violations, and in the lived experience of Palestinians. To better understand the nature of this deal and the mindset behind it, we turn to Dimitri Lascaris, whose latest analysis offers critical insight into the ceasefire's terms, the political calculations at play, and what this moment means for Gaza, Palestine, and the broader resistance. Let's listen closely, not just to the words, but to the patterns.
Good day, this is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you for Reason to Resist from Kalamata, Greece on October 10th, 2025. An Israeli reporter has published the signed ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel. Gilly Cohen of Israel's Khan News Agency posted the main part of the agreement on X last night, and that part of the agreement consists of a single page. And here's what Cohen posted. And based on reporting I've seen and the signatures which appear at the bottom of the page here, this is in fact a copy of the one-page agreement. Now, I'd like to take you through this one-page agreement in detail because its precise terms are extremely important. But before I do that, be aware that this is not the entire agreement. Paragraph 3 makes reference to an attachment which sets forth the implementation steps for the introduction of humanitarian aid into Gaza. I haven't found a copy of that attachment yet. Paragraph 4 refers to a map, very important map, which shows the lines to which Israel's genocide forces must withdraw upon the beginning of the process. Haven't found a copy of that map either. And finally, paragraph 5F refers to an agreed list of the Palestinian prisoners to be released by Israel in accordance or in parallel with the release of the Israeli prisoners of war held by the resistance in Gaza. And I haven't found a copy of that list of prisoners either. In fact, at 4:10 a.m. local time today, October 10th, the Palestinian Prisoners Media Office issued a statement that the list of Palestinian prisoners to be released has not yet been agreed upon. And the statement read, quote, "As of now, no agreement has been reached regarding the list of prisoners, and the circulating lists concerning the prisoners intended for release as part of the exchange deal are inaccurate lists. The occupation is promoting these lists with the aim of pressuring and disrupting the course of negotiations. Official lists, if an agreement is reached, will be announced and published through the platforms of the Prisoners Media Office." And I just checked resistance channels and did not see the published list. Now, when it comes to the published list, perhaps the final list of prisoners to be released, I should say, perhaps the biggest question of all will be whether the Israelis will release resistance leader Marwan Barghouti, who has been languishing in an Israeli dungeon for over 20 years on charges, trumped up charges of involvement in terrorist acts against Israelis. Barghouti is important because according to polls, including but not limited to the one that was conducted by a reputable polling agency in occupied Palestine in May of this year, just a few months ago, in a three-way election involving a Hamas candidate, the leader of Hamas, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader or president of the Palestinian Authority, and Marwan Barghouti, Marwan Barghouti would win by a significant margin with about 50% of the vote, with the Hamas candidate coming in second with about 35% and Mahmoud Abbas with a lowly, pitiable 11% of the vote. So clearly, this is a figure who commands great respect amongst the Palestinian people living under occupation. And I don't know whether at this stage he's in any condition to run for political office, to serve as the leader of the Palestinian people, but certainly he continues to enjoy widespread support. And the resistance has repeatedly demanded in its negotiations over these 2 years of genocide with the Israeli entity, the release of Marwan Barghouti. So all of that remains to be seen. In any case, what's clear is that we still need to see key parts of this agreement to understand its full significance. And I'm not even clear that every undisclosed part of this agreement, every exhibit or attachment to it, has been finalized and agreed upon. So in any case, let's look at the one pager more closely. And to begin, I'd like to note that Hamas officials have said repeatedly that the agreement provides for a permanent end to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. And in fact, as I hope you can see here, there's a lot of support for that claim in this agreement. First, there's the title, and the title is Implementation Steps for President Trump's Proposal for a, quote, comprehensive end of Gaza war. So the title certainly suggests that the purpose of this agreement is to bring a comprehensive end to the war, but there's much more than that. Paragraph 2 states, quote, "The war will immediately end upon the approval of the Israeli government," close quote. So here we're not talking about a suspension of the war. We're not talking about a pause of the war. We're not talking even about a temporary ceasefire. It says the war will immediately end. And according to Israeli media, Netanyahu's cabinet have approved the deal. They did so early this morning. And I'm going to come back to that, the whole question of how and in what circumstances it was approved by the Netanyahu cabinet. But before I get into that subject, I also want to point out that paragraph 2 of this agreement contains an important word. It says that upon approval of the agreement, all military operations will be suspended. So there they use the term suspended, but they do not use the word terminated. So the use of the word suspended suggests that under certain circumstances, military operations can be resumed. Those circumstances, if in fact that's what meant by the word suspended, they're not specified in this agreement, but I would assume that the circumstance in which the military operations may resume would only be where Hamas fails to comply with its obligations under the agreement. Now, in terms of the finality of Israel's military operations in the Gaza Strip, paragraph 4 contains another key statement. It says that the Israeli military, quote, will not return, close quote, to areas it has withdrawn from as per the attached map, quote, as long as Hamas fully implements the agreement, close quote. So again, there you have an explicit, statement that it's only in circumstances where Hamas fails to comply with its part of the agreement that Israel may return to the parts of the Gaza Strip where it has withdrawn from. So this agreement clearly envisions a permanent withdrawal from certain parts of the Gaza Strip, although we don't know exactly which parts as of yet. Moreover, and this too is critically important, the agreement says nothing about the IDF's withdrawal from parts of the Gaza Strip that it will continue to occupy after the initial withdrawal. The agreement does not even contain an explicit commitment from Israel to negotiate in good faith for a complete withdrawal. Now, this may not be as important as it sounds on its face, because based on the reports I've seen, what Israel is withdrawing to is a narrow buffer zone around the perimeter of the Gaza Strip. And it's what it's undertaken to do is to withdraw for the vast majority of the Gaza Strip. And as I say, this agreement explicitly provides that if Hamas complies with its end of the bargain, the Israeli military will not return to the parts of the Gaza Strip from which it is obliged to withdraw. Now, why doesn't the agreement provide that ultimately there will be a total withdrawal even from the buffer zone around the perimeter of Gaza? I suspect that what has happened here is that Hamas has received verbal assurances from the Trump regime that negotiations will continue over a complete withdrawal from the Gaza Strip after the prisoner exchange. The question, of course, is whether those assurances are worth anything. And that, of course, remains to be seen. So in any case, and for the reasons I just cited, the agreement clearly envisions a permanent end to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and a permanent withdrawal from the vast majority of the Gaza Strip. So if anyone claims that this agreement does not envision a permanent end to Israel's war in Gaza or a permanent withdrawal, then either they're lying or they simply haven't reviewed this agreement carefully or at all. Another key aspect of the agreement is, of course, the provision of humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. Paragraph 3 provides for the, quote, immediate commencement of full entry of humanitarian aid and relief as determined in the proposal, and at a minimum consistent with the January 19, 2025 agreement regarding humanitarian aid, close quote. This raises the question of what Trump's 20-point proposal says about humanitarian aid. Well, there are two paragraphs in that proposal, and they read as follows, which concern humanitarian aid, and they read as follows. It's paragraph 7. Upon acceptance of this agreement, full aid will be immediately sent into the Gaza Strip. At a minimum, aid quantities will be consistent with that, with what was included in the 19 January 2025 agreement regarding humanitarian aid, including rehabilitation of infrastructure, water, electricity, sewage, rehabilitation of hospitals and bakeries, and entry of necessary equipment to remove rubble and open roads. And paragraph 8 of the 20-point Trump proposal says, entry of distribution and aid in the Gaza Strip will proceed without interference from the two parties through the United Nations and its agencies and the Red Crescent, in addition to other international institutions not associated in any manner with either party. Opening the Rafah crossing in both directions will be subject to the same mechanism implemented under 19 January 2025 agreement, close quote. So the upshot is that under this agreement, this one pager, which I'm showing you on the screen here, the United Nations Relief Works Agency and other international agencies that are independent of Israel must be permitted to deliver humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. This, of course, is important because the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, as it's called, this beast that was established by Israel and the Americans several months ago, purportedly to deliver aid to the starving population of Gaza, turned out to be nothing but a tool for the mass murder of Palestinians seeking desperately needed humanitarian assistance. GHF assassins murdered more than 2,600 Palestinians at aid distribution points since GHF was established several months ago. The assassins also wounded more than 19,000 Palestinian civilians at these aid distribution points during those several months. So it is extremely important, needless to say, that independent humanitarian agencies assume responsibility for distributing aid to the people of Gaza. Now, as for the quantity of aid that will be allowed into Gaza under this agreement, the agreement says that the aid must, at a minimum, be consistent with the prior ceasefire agreement entered into on January 19th of this year. That agreement provided as follows. Israel would have to allow the entry of sufficient quantities of humanitarian aid, 600 trucks per day, of which 300 are for the north. Included in this were 50 fuel trucks, including the fuel necessary for operating the power plant, trade, and equipment needed for rubble removal, rehabilitation, and operation of hospitals, health centers, and bakeries in all areas of the Gaza Strip. Closed quote. Now, if Israel complies with that requirement, it would clearly result in a dramatic improvement in the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. But let's recall what happened under the January ceasefire agreement. From the time it was agreed, Israel's genocide forces killed Palestinians on a near daily basis and substantially hindered the entry of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. And in fact, this led to the suspension by Hamas of the release of hostages. And ultimately, the release of the hostages was resumed, but there was nearly a blow up of the agreement at that point in time. And ultimately, once the resistance released the hostages it had agreed to release in the initial phases of that agreement, and the point came for Israel to withdraw, as it had undertaken to do under the January 19th agreement from Rafah, Israel refused to withdraw, tore up the agreement, and started starving the civilian population of Gaza. The flimsy excuse that Israel offered for its killing of Palestinians while the January 19 agreement was in effect, its daily killing of Palestinians, and its hindrance of humanitarian aid, was that Hamas, it alleged, was violating the deal with delays in providing the names of hostages. Even if there were delays in providing the names of hostages, no sane person with an ounce of human decency would think that that justifies killing Palestinian civilians as Israel did, or depriving them of desperately needed humanitarian aid. So the lesson here is that Israel will come up with any half-assed reason it can concoct to continue the killing and starvation of Palestinians. It remains to be seen whether that is something that will happen here and whether the Trump regime will allow Israel to do this again. Now, the balance of this one-page agreement has to do with the exchange of hostages, living and dead. The exchange of hostages is to happen within 72 hours of the withdrawal of Israeli forces, as per paragraph 5 of the one-pager. And as I've indicated, that withdrawal is being claimed by Israeli media to have been completed as of several minutes ago or a couple of hours ago. And the Palestinian resistance factions must hand over their 20 Israeli POWs within that 72-hour period. And paragraph 5F of this one-pager states that as Hamas releases its hostages, Israel must release, quote, in parallel, the corresponding number of Palestinian prisoners as per the attached list, close quote, which unfortunately we don't have. Not only do we not have them, we don't even know for sure that the list has been agreed upon, but Hamas has stated repeatedly that the lists consist of 1,700 prisoners from Gaza and 250 Palestinians serving life sentences. Now, there's one other aspect of this prisoner exchange agreement that is, in my view, particularly odious, namely, paragraph 5G prohibits any public ceremonies or media coverage of the release of prisoners and hostages. Now, I can understand if Israel were demanding that there be no ceremonies involving the release, at least ceremonies in the Gaza Strip, involving the release of its POWs. But there's no conceivable justification for Israel demanding that there be no ceremonies or media coverage of the 2,000 or so Palestinians that are being released from its dungeons. Many of them, if not all of them, have been subjected to various levels and forms of torture and severe privation. There's no doubt that that will be apparent from their appearance. And upon their release from prison, they will be asked about this. I'm sure that many of them will be anxious to tell the public and their fellow Palestinians what they endured under the brutalities of Israeli incarceration. This prohibition on ceremonies and media coverage of the release of Palestinian prisoners can only be designed to do two things, and that is, first, impede the delivery of the truth to the public about what was done to those prisoners in jail, and secondly, to prevent the Palestinians from uniting in what is an important victory for the resistance and, you know, sharing in a moment, a desperately needed moment of national unity and relief and joy at the release of their brothers and sisters from Israeli dungeons. Again, just another example of how the Israeli genocidal regime does everything within its power to prevent the truth of what it is doing to the Palestinian people from reaching those of us living here in the West. Now, it's a virtual certainty that when many of these prisoners are released, and I'm talking here about the Palestinian prisoners, ordinary Palestinians who are there at the moment when they are released or when they arrive in their communities, will post videos on social media. And one must wonder what heinous crimes will Israel commit when that happens? Will it claim that this constitutes media coverage and it's a violation of the agreement? Will they use that as an excuse to beat, jail, or even kill more Palestinians? Again, that is a question that remains to be resolved. Finally, this agreement is important for what it does not say. It does not say, unlike Trump's 20-point proposal, that the resistance must disarm. And in fact, it says nothing about disarmament at all. Now, Western media continue to this very day to report without citing any credible, identifiable sources that Hamas may be willing to agree to a complete or partial disarmament. For example, a partial disarmament might involve Hamas giving up its missiles but retaining its small arms. However, Hamas has consistently and emphatically denied those reports. And let me repeat, it would be the height of indecency for anybody to demand that Palestinian resistance factions disarm, the lightly armed Palestinian resistance factions give up all of their weapons, their limited weaponry, while the perpetrator of this genocide, Israel, remains armed to the teeth. If anybody should be required to disarm first, it should be the perpetrator of genocide and not its victims. Now, returning to the one-pager, it also says nothing about the future governance of the Gaza Strip or the presence of foreign troops in Gaza or the departure of Hamas officials into exile. As for the issue of foreign troops in Gaza, Western media, including the New York Times, reported as follows this morning, and I'm quoting from the New York Times, The United States is sending 200 troops to Israel to monitor the implementation of the ceasefire deal in Gaza, U.S. officials said Thursday. The official said U.S. Central Command will establish a civil military coordination center in Israel to provide security and humanitarian support. The U.S. troops will join soldiers from nations including Egypt, Qatar, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates to provide oversight. The U.S. troops are not intended to go into Gaza, one of the U.S. officials said. So, assuming we're being told the truth here, that the coordination center will be in Israel and the troops will not go into Gaza, this is not intended to be an occupation force or police force in Gaza. And even if it were, 200 troops would hardly be sufficient to the task. That number of troops is a pittance relative to the geographical size and population of the Gaza Strip. These 200 troops, in my view, might actually be a good thing for Palestinians, because Trump might have learned, based on the prior ceasefire agreement, that it's not wise to trust Netanyahu to observe the terms of these agreements. And perhaps Trump is sending the 200 soldiers to Israel to keep an eye on the delivery of humanitarian aid, maybe also to monitor what is going on in the Gaza Strip from the border of the Gaza Strip, to see if there is any bombing, drone strikes, airstrikes, artillery shells falling on the Gaza Strip during the period where military operations are supposed to be halted. Again, we shall see what purpose these 200 troops will serve. The bottom line, my friends, is that the one-page agreement says nothing about the long-term issues confronting the Palestinian people, not even the reconstruction of Gaza, and does not even contain an explicit commitment to negotiate the longer-term and underlying issues. And in particular, the agreement says nothing about a Palestinian state. It also says nothing, not one word, about the West Bank, where Israel is also committing genocide, albeit at a lower level of intensity than in Gaza. So what is the ultimate significance of this agreement? In my view, if Israel complies with this agreement, it means a hell of a lot for the Palestinians, because that would result in a permanent end to the war on Gaza, a permanent withdrawal from much, if not all, of Gaza, and the provision of sufficient humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, along with the release of nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. These are vitally important developments to be welcomed by all people of conscience for the people of Gaza. But at the same time, even if Israel complies fully with the deal, the core underlying injustices of the occupation will persist, and no one would or should have the slightest faith in Israel to voluntarily address those injustices in a manner that is fair to the Palestinian people. So even if Israel complies fully with the deal, the core underlying problems will remain. Even worse, of course, Israel might simply flush the agreement down the toilet once it has its POWs back. When it comes to the question of whether Israel will comply, I think we can glean a lot from examining the reactions of the most lunatic ministers in Israel's cabinet, those who are typically referred to by the press as far right, although, again, any rational human being would regard every single member of Netanyahu's cabinet as being far right, and in particular, the arch war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu himself. Now, why do I say we can divine Israel's true intentions from their reaction? Because if they, the most lunatic members of his cabinet, approve of the deal, even grudgingly, or if they are quiet about it, then the most logical inference is that Netanyahu has given them private assurances that he'll break the deal, resume the mass murder of Palestinians, and reoccupy the Gaza Strip. So this, of course, raises the question of how the lunatics have responded thus far. And here you'll see an article that was published this morning at 3:32 a.m. by the Times of Israel. Gaza ceasefire takes effect as the government approves deal to free the hostages. The subheading there, most far-right ministers vote against agreement to halt fighting with Hamas. Kushner and Witkoff tell cabinet that IDF's bravery, yes, the latte-sipping baby killers are being lauded for their bravery by Kushner and Witkoff. They commend Netanyahu's difficult decisions and say that those decisions enabled the agreement. Now, the Times of Israel goes on and reports as follows. Netanyahu's office announced the approval of the deal but did not immediately provide a vote tally, though the agreement was opposed by National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, Negev, Galilee, and National Resilience Minister Yitzhak Wasserlof, and Heritage Minister Amichai Eliyahu of the far-right Otzma Yehudit Party. If I'm not mistaken, Eliyahu was the psychopathic lunatic who at some point during the genocide called for Israel to nuke Gaza. In any event, the Times of Israel article goes on and says far-right leaders have been critical of the deal, with Smotrich announcing on Thursday that religious Zionism would not vote in favor. Speaking with the Times of Israel, a party source said that it remained up in the air whether or not the far-right faction would bolt the government. Ben-Gvir had also announced ahead of the cabinet meeting that Otzma Yehudit would vote against the first phase of the deal, in which Palestinian prisoners will be released in exchange for all 48 Israeli hostages held in Gaza. So 48, I think, refers obviously not only to the 20 living POWs, but also the remains of 28 other captives who died in captivity. What is my take on these revelations? I do draw some encouragement from them. Clearly, most lunatic members of Netanyahu's cabinet are not being silent about this. They're not agreeing to it. Their opposition to it seems to be quite vigorous. But I'm a little bit troubled by the fact that none of them has announced a decision to bolt from Netanyahu's coalition. So I do remain suspicious on that basis, just on the basis of Israel's long and sordid history of violating ceasefire agreements, about whether or not Netanyahu will comply with this agreement even substantially, let alone completely. So let's move on and let's talk about the all-important question of what the Trump is going to do to ensure Israel's compliance. Now, some are saying that Trump is serious this time about bringing an end to the war in Gaza because he desperately wants the Nobel Peace Prize. I understand that the winner of that Peace Prize is going to be announced today. And let me say in passing that in a sane and decent world, the winner of that Peace Prize would be Francesca Albanese, the extraordinarily brave, intelligent, and eloquent UN Special Rapporteur for the human rights situation in occupied Palestine. I've read reports that she's been nominated. But frankly, I don't have much confidence in the Nobel Committee to award the prize to Francesca Albanese. And it is not at all beyond them to award the prize to this psychopathic, bloodthirsty mass murderer, Donald Trump, because they've made similar, although perhaps not quite as egregious, decisions in the past, awarding the prize to people who had no right to claim or expect the Nobel Peace Prize, including, for example, the war criminal Barack Obama. And by the way, he was by no means the worst choice of the Nobel Committee. But I digress. The point I want to make here is I find it incredible, really, that the main motivation that Trump has for doing this deal is because he wants to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I do recognize that he is extraordinarily narcissistic and a megalomaniac. And I don't doubt for one second that he wants this Peace Prize and that he'd love to have this Peace Prize. But if he was so enamored of the Nobel Peace Prize, why did he allow Israel to tear up the agreement back in March and then begin to starve the civilian population of Gaza? Why has it taken until now for Trump to do anything to bring this horror to an end? Why did Trump allow Israel and enable Israel to launch a criminal war of aggression on Iran and even participate through the B2 bombing of Iran's nuclear sites, a war crime. In the war on Iran, why did he wage war against Ansar Allah in Yemen? This doesn't sound like a person who seriously strives to, you know, win the Nobel Peace Prize. Although, again, I say I would not at all be surprised if he would be very happy to have it. And I'm sure that he does covet the Nobel Peace Prize. But when it comes ultimately to the question of whether he has pressured and will pressure Israel to comply with this agreement, I think that really is going to be driven by other factors of a very self-serving nature, things that are much more important to the Donald than some prize from the Nobel Committee. For example, Donald Trump, if I were him, I would be deeply concerned about the midterm elections. Right now, Donald Trump's approval rating is very low. There are serious problems developing in the U.S. economy. Most Americans, in fact, do not approve of Donald Trump's handling of the economy. And you'd think that that's one area where he would at least be able to have majority approval. They don't approve of much of anything at all that the Donald is doing. And let us recall that the Donald, one of the ways in which he secured a second term in the White House was to lie through his teeth about wanting to bring an end to America's wars and about wanting to prevent embroiling America in any new wars. He came into the White House and immediately began to involve America in new wars. And all of his rhetoric and all of the energies that he claimed to have invested in bringing an end to the Ukraine war have come to naught. Donald Trump is now fully on board with the enterprise of Ukraine. He said as much with Ukraine trying to recapture all of its territory, which is a practical impossibility. He has been encouraging the Europeans to drastically increase their military spending and continue funding this war. Simply, all he's done with respect to the Ukraine war is try to reallocate the burden of funding it from the United States to Europe. But there's no indication whatsoever that Donald Trump is going to come anywhere close to doing what's necessary to bringing that war to an end. So basically, he has betrayed his base. He's betrayed his base, and this manifested itself, you know, when Charlie Kirk, and there are credible reports of this, chastised Trump directly to his face for the war on Iran. So there are a lot of people, independents who voted for Trump, people who are Republicans, registered Republicans, and who voted for Trump, who are unhappy about the fact that Donald Trump has repeatedly betrayed his promise to be the president of peace. And if this genocide were to continue right up until the midterms, I have no doubt about the fact that Netanyahu is capable of carrying this on for years to come. As long as there is a, you know, there are bullets in the guns of the Israeli military and bombs in the, you know, aircraft bays of the warplanes supplied by the United States to the Israeli Air Force, they will continue to kill Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, and then probably also in East Jerusalem and within the 1948 boundaries of Israel itself. And Donald Trump surely understands this. And he surely understands, I would think, because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out, that the longer that this bloodbath goes on, the more and more support he is going to lose from his base. And that will spell doom with him, for him and the Republican Party in the midterms. Trust me, folks, the last thing that Donald wants is to lose control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. At this stage, given the way he has behaved, there's every reason to believe that he would be subjected to another impeachment proceeding, and that that impeachment proceeding could succeed if the Democrats win enough seats in the House and the Senate. And the Donald surely doesn't want to have to face another impeachment proceeding. He's much more vulnerable now to impeachment than he was in the first term. He's basically, you know, using the United States Constitution as toilet paper, running roughshod over the basic civil liberties of Americans, you know, engaging in outrageous overreach of the executive powers of the president. So I think he must be quite concerned about this. And to me, that is probably the biggest point of pressure on Donald Trump to bring this slaughter to an end, his concern about the midterm elections. And of course, the Zionist lobby must be very concerned about the precipitous decline in American support for Israel. And there may be some powerful, influential Zionists behind the scenes who are prodding Donald to bring this horror show to an end, not because they care at all about any Palestinian lives, but because they care about American support for Israel. It is, after all, a matter of existential importance to the genocidal entity that the United States government continue to support it in every way imaginable. And, you know, things got quite complicated for the Donald over the last few weeks as more and more revelations have emerged about the killing of Charlie Kirk. This could really do serious permanent damage to MAGA's support for Israel. And the most recent revelation only within the past few days came from Candace Owens in the form of a text involving, or an exchange of texts involving Charlie Kirk and various persons or colleagues of his at TPUSA just before he was murdered. And I'm going to show you that text here, which, by the way, has been authenticated by the leadership of TPUSA. And you'll see Charlie Kirk writes at the top, "Just lost another huge Jewish donor, $2 million a year because we won't cancel Tucker." Tucker Carlson, of course, having turned against Israel himself in recent months. And he then goes on and says, Kirk, he writes here, "I'm thinking of inviting Candace." And somebody replies, "We don't know who, ugh." 2 minutes after Kirk says, "I'm thinking of inviting Candace. Then Kirk says, "Jewish donors play into all the stereotypes. I cannot and will not be bullied like this, leaving me no choice but to leave the pro-Israel cause." That is a bombshell, folks. You know, days before he was murdered, this extremely influential MAGA personality, who had been a diehard, ironclad supporter of Israel in all of his public commentary up until the last few months of his life, openly stating, writing to colleagues of his at this extremely well-funded and influential MAGA organization, stating explicitly that he will have no choice but to leave the pro-Israel cause. So there were already a lot of suspicions about Israel's involvement in all of this before this text came out. And I'm not saying there's direct evidence of Israel's involvement. I'm not aware of any direct evidence. But I'm simply commenting upon the fact, which is understandable, that there's a lot of suspicion out there because, after all, if there's one thing that Israel is good at, it's murdering civilians who put up any form of opposition or resistance to its domination and its crimes. And by the way, for those of you who are interested, somebody then goes on and responds to that last statement by Kirk by trying to dissuade him from inviting Candace Owens. He said, this person writes, "That might feel good short term, but it's not good long term, in my opinion. Like all groups, you're going to get wide variety of opinions, blah, blah, blah." So this is the context in which, the political context in which Donald Trump is currently operating. And to me, that political context is likely having a far greater impact on Donald Trump's thinking about the genocidal rampage of Israel in Gaza than his desire to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, while I'm on the subject of the reasons why the Donald might very well be serious this time about ending the war, there is, of course, the decrepit state of the Israeli military. The Israeli military was not constructed to fight a multi-front war for consecutive years. And we're now entering the third year of its genocidal rampage in Gaza, and also its fighting of multiple fronts, on multiple fronts, including South Lebanon. So as we've talked about many times on this program, you know, there are tens of thousands of Israeli reservists, perhaps over 100,000, who are refusing to show up for service. There is a crisis of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and suicide in the Israeli military. The weapon stocks of Israel have undoubtedly been severely depleted, as have those of the United States, its main arms supplier, and Germany, its second biggest arms supplier, not just because Israel itself has consumed massive amounts of munitions in Gaza and in other areas where it has waged a campaign of destruction of West Asia, but also at the same time, the United States, Germany, and other Western military suppliers of Israel have been supplying Ukraine. And that is a conflict that has consumed even more munitions than Israel has consumed, I would imagine. So you're looking at highly depleted weapon stocks, a demoralized and exhausted army, various forms of crisis within the Israeli military. I would not at all be surprised if, you know, people within the Israeli military itself have secretly, or perhaps not so secretly, appealed to the Trump regime to bring this to an end. And there may be people, powerful and influential people in the Zionist lobby in the United States who are in contact with the Israeli military and understand the gravity of the situation, who have been politely and quietly requesting that Donald Trump bring this to an end when it's so obvious that Netanyahu himself was unwilling to do so. So again, I think this is likely to be much more important to Donald Trump than the Nobel Peace Prize. But I don't purport to be able to read the mind of this psychopath, nor do I want to try. Now, while I'm on the subject of the Israeli military and its decrepit condition, two more uniformed Israeli terrorists were killed in Gaza in the hours leading up to the Netanyahu regime's approval of the deal. And this was in two separate incidents. The first one involved a reservist. This reservist was killed by sniper fire in Gaza City just before the Gaza deal agreement was approved. The uniformed terrorist's name was Sergeant First Class Michael Mordecai Nachmani. He fell in the northern Gaza Strip where Israel was supposed to be in control, and he was killed by a sniper while operating in Gaza City, according to the Mariv newspaper. In addition, just before the Netanyahu cabinet approved the ceasefire agreement, another Israeli terrorist was killed in the Gaza Strip after resistance fighters attempted to capture him. And here's the description of that operation from the Palestinian side. This was published within the last 24 hours or so by the Al-Qassam Brigades. This report, it says, Al-Qassam fighters managed yesterday afternoon, Wednesday, to raid the Al-Ahwad military site on the Netzarim access south of the Tal al-Hawa neighborhood south of Gaza City. Our fighters initiated clashes with enemy soldiers from point-blank range, killing and wounding a number of them. I repeat, a number of them. Our fighters targeted two Zionist Merkava tanks with Al-Yassin 105 and tandem shells. Our fighters attempted to capture one of the enemy soldiers, but field conditions did not allow it. Our fighters monitored the landing of evacuation helicopters, which lasted for more than an hour. So that sounds like there were quite significant casualties. Now, as I indicated, brigades say that they killed and wounded numerous Israeli soldiers. There has been a partial confirmation of this operation by the genocidal military. This is a report in Israel Hayom published on the 7th. It says here that an IDF soldier was killed after resisting abduction attempt in Gaza. He was a bulldozer operator, and he was killed in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip after engaging in a struggle with terrorists who attempted to abduct him. In fact, the person who was killed, the soldier or so-called soldier, is the terrorist. It is not terrorism for people living under occupation to attack the military forces that are oppressing them. That's just an obvious truth as a matter of international law. The Palestinians living under occupation have a right under international law to engage in armed resistance, and the person who is the terrorist in this scenario was clearly the bulldozer operator, who was almost certainly using his heavy machinery to wreak yet more destruction on civilian infrastructure. So, my friends, that is my latest update as to resistance military operations in the Gaza Strip. At the same time as this was going on, the resistance was continuing to inflict casualties on Israel's genocide forces. Israel was continuing the mass murder of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. From the Cradle Report, dozens of Palestinians were missing, several killed and injured after Israel bombed the home of the Gaboon family on Al-Alatini Street in Gaza City.
الله اكبر يوسف مرقنا مكانه طلع خلص 100% سيبه يا حموده.
You can see there that appears to have been a child who was retrieved from the rubble, wounded, but fortunately alive. Who knows how many were killed in that murderous strike in Gaza City in the hours leading up to the Netanyahu regime's approval of the agreement. Now, on a happier note, after midnight today, the Israeli Army radio reported that the ceasefire went into effect overnight. Israeli army attacks in the Gaza Strip have stopped, and the army will soon complete its withdrawal to the Yellow Line. That was the claim of Israeli Army Radio. However, there are, in addition, multiple reports on resistance channels of Israel's genocide forces leaving the Gaza Strip. And Israeli media reported just before I began this report that Israeli forces have withdrawn to the agreed-upon line, meaning that the 72-hour countdown has begun. Finally, let me offer a perspective on what will happen if Israel does what it always has done and treats this agreement like toilet paper. Well, in my submission to you, my friends, that would put Israel in an even worse place than it is now, and it's already in a very, very dark place because it has used the fact that the resistance forces in the Gaza Strip have custody of Israeli soldiers. Of course, they're never described as soldiers in the Western media or by the political elites in the West or in Israel. They're always just simply referred to as hostages. There's no reference to the fact that they were serving in Israel's criminal military at the time that they were taken captive on October 7th. But let's put that detail aside for a moment. The fact is that the captivity of these 20 soldiers has been used repeatedly as an excuse by the Netanyahu regime to visit horrible suffering upon the civilian population of Gaza. And although I don't doubt Netanyahu's ability to invent some kind of pretext for continuing the slaughter even after these 20 POWs have been recovered by Israel, I think it will be much harder for Netanyahu to argue that the violence should be continued, particularly violence directing civilians, if these hostages have been returned or these POWs have been returned to Israel. In a sense, at a bare minimum, what's going to happen here, in addition to the release of Palestinian prisoners, which is in and of itself is very important, and even if this is just a temporary pause in the bombing of the people of Gaza, and even if the increase in humanitarian aid is substantial but temporary, those are certainly good things, important things, vitally important things for the civilian population of Gaza. But I think that in effect, by handing over the POWs, the resistance has situated itself more firmly on the moral high ground. And if we see a resumption now of the horrors that the Palestinians have endured for the past 2 years, I think that you are going to see an even more rapid and precipitous decline in the standing of Israel in the West, in the broader world. And it is already arguably the most detested so-called country on God's green earth. So one way or another, this thing is coming to an end. This genocide will not succeed. It's just a question of when, not if. Perhaps now is the time Perhaps we're going to have to wait a little longer, but that day is coming, and judgment day is coming for all the criminals who perpetrated this crime.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC. And that brings us to the close of today's episode of This Week in Palestine. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power and illuminate the path to justice. I'm your host, Bethany Marks, and it's been a profound honor to share this space with you, a space where truth is spoken without compromise. Resistance is honored without apology, and solidarity is never up for negotiation. If you have reflections, questions, or would like to support the work we do, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. A heartfelt thank you to you, our listeners, and to the brilliant team behind the scenes whose vision and dedication make this show possible. Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Arashid, Juliette Salome Olivier, Renaud Al-Ghul, and Mohammed Al-Ghul, your labor, spirit, and unwavering commitment keep this platform alive and beating. Until next time, keep walking toward truth. Keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for walking this path with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care and stay steadfast.
Walk with me, my son, up over the hill. Let me show you the land where our memories still live. See those broken stones where the old house once stood. That was our home, where we laughed and we loved. That big farm right there, with the olives so green, they stole it from us. You know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands, taking all that we need. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields, remember our name. One day we'll return, I swear it again. We gathered here, family, under the moon. Stories and songs now all gone too soon. They burned every door, they tore every wall. But they'll never take what we carry in our souls. Teach your children the truth, let it live in their veins. This land is ours, no matter the chains. Through fire and time, through exile and years, our roots run too deep to be washed by their tears. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields, remember our name. One day we'll return, I swear it again. So walk with me, son, don't turn away. Hold this land in your heart every day. For as long as we breathe, the promise remains. We will
home again. Look, son, I'm still holding the key.